Purchase new wiper blades from O'Reilly Auto Parts today and we'll install them for free. See better and drive safer with O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
The regular season is heating up, new stars are emerging, and that means more opportunities to win up to 25 times your cash on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection on a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's that easy. Let it fly to turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Watch your favorite players and get paid doing it this basketball season. See your entries make progress during the game or make new entries for the second half and the fourth quarter. Three-pointers, assists, rebounds, and everything in between are yours for the taking. Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit of up to $100. Just download the Prize Picks app and use code GET100. That's code GET100 on Prize Picks for a first deposit match of up to $100. Prize Picks, pick more, pick less. It's that easy.
Okay, just try it. Take one. I'll just have cheese and lettuce and all my sandwich and coffee.
Hello and welcome to episode 239 of Something About the Beatles. We've been kind of on a roll lately in terms of productivity and getting shows out. I'm trying to adhere to this 3-episode per month schedule, or one every 10 days. And hopefully it's not too big for you guys all to keep up with. But I think that once you get a system down, it's hard to step away from it. And I may take a break at some point, but on the other hand, I did record a lot of content in the past week, and that will probably be taking us at least through October, with still more shows that have been delayed that were proposed to be taped due to various reasons, but lots of stuff. And to return back to something that came up, about a month or so ago when I'd asked you guys to send in questions. You guys sent in a ton of great things, and clearly, some of it's going to take a bit of work to research down. There's things I can speak to off the top of my head, and there's things that, wow, I need to see if I can come up with better answers for this stuff. So, working on that. Working on some other stuff as related to that question I'd put out there about a civil law lawyer. Got some great responses from you guys, so that will be coming. I got a listener who was at Glastonbury. We're going to get that story. I haven't quite nailed it down yet, but somebody stepped up, so I'm happy to have that. Got some other Beatle witness event encounter stories come my way going back some decades, and that's great. I'm really wanting to keep this thing rolling, so that will be coming. So in an array of platforms and venues and outlets, there will be lots of content continuing to come. It's just, it's funny when you ask for something, how people will step up and oblige you, and there's been tons of great stuff. So keep it coming. Keep it coming. Also, some other people reaching out to me, volunteering themselves as guests on the show, which is also really cool. Some names that may be familiar to you. There's going to be, well, there's in the works now, there's a popular guest who's been on the show a number of times, hadn't been on in a while, was taking a bit of a break, coming back, got that show coming up, got another returning guest, very popular guest, somebody in Beatle World who's been on the show twice, coming back to discuss another sort of oblique intersection related to Beatle World, post-Beatle World, actually, that he wants to discuss and I want to ask him about because I think it's fascinating. So the thing to know if you're new to the show is that I don't limit discussions or interviews or topics strictly to Quarrymen through 1970. There's plenty of solo things, as you guys know, but also ancillary things that hopefully you guys are interested in, because they're interesting to me, and that's basically my rule of thumb when I put these shows together. If I find it interesting, maybe you guys will too, which is how I can justify having a Mary Hopkins show or a show on Apple artists, handmade films, things like that, that aren't strictly Beatles per se, that they're Beatle-related. It's important to get as much history nailed down while you've got participants around to talk about it as possible. That's kind of the philosophy I go into with this. So you may see some shows coming up where I'm going way back with people that that still walk the earth that were privy to something Beatle-related that I think is worth talking about. So that could happen too, because I am very conscious of mortality these days, to put it one way. And with this show, we're bringing back Kevin Harrington, who has been on the show before, had him, I guess it was in 2019, when we were thinking 50th year of Let It Be, the Get Back project, had him on then. He was part of Fab Four Con twice as a rooftop witness and then part of the Mal Evans segment that we did. And I was very keen to get him back on the show after Get Back dropped, the eight-hour Peter Jackson Get Back. I will tell you straight up front, the conversation didn't go the way I expected it to, but that doesn't make it any less valuable, because ultimately what we have here is a living witness who was a fly on the wall during the last three Beatle albums, White Album through Get Back, Let It Be, through Abbey Road. Saw a lot of things, experienced things, and then went on to have quite the musical career after that, working with other bands, starting with Derek and the Dominoes. But really what I wanted to get was his reaction to Get Back, which you'll get, and just other thoughts and impressions that he had of his Beatle years. He did write the book, The Redhead on the Roof, which basically serves as his memoir. I do recommend it. It is a slim but charming volume, and he actually began as a younger teen working for NEMS as an office boy before pivoting into equipment manager and sort of Mal's right-hand guy during the last studio years. So it's definitely worth checking out. We had that discussion the first time he was on the show. This is more follow-up questions, that sort of thing, picking his brain on what he can recall at this point. And he's a great guy. He's a great guest. Love having him on. We'll have him on again. But you'll see that the intent with this show is just to nail down as many living witnesses as we can access at this point. There's plenty of people left on the list. I'm sure there's some names that you guys can all think of, and there's plenty that I have tried very hard to track down. Some people that want to be tracked down. There are people who are connected to other guests on the show that they've said they would put me in touch, and sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't. So all I can do is just keep on keeping on and hope all that happens. So we'll see, but I am not giving up. The biggest takeaway is that lots of shows coming. I've basically got the rest of the year plotted out, and there are things that come your way that you can't anticipate. And so far, lots of good things are starting to come to fruition. I will tell you that. This show is brought to you by BetterHelp, and hopefully you guys are checking out their site and also the deal that they have for Sappy listeners. 10% off your first month of treatment. Go to betterhelp.com/sappy to get your 10% off. But in the meantime, check out this conversation with Kevin Harrington, delightful guest, great memoir worth checking out, The Redhead on the Roof. But let's just start with Kevin's reaction to Get Back, which won't take much time.
Do you want to do it once more then?
Yes, yes. At least once more. I mean, we'll never get a chance to do it again.
I'm sure I asked you this at one point before. And in fact, I know I did. When the original Let It Be came out, you saw it. And I think you'd made the observation of how ridiculous it looked, the opening shots, you and Mal pushing the piano, and how that was a normal part of things. It was clearly staged.
Yeah, that was very staged.
Yeah, yeah. But overall, did you have any particular impression that stayed with you of Let It Be, the film from back then, in terms of what it caught and how it meshed with your own memories of the experience?
It didn't mesh with how I felt it was at the time.
In what way?
It just wasn't as fun.
So it definitely, in your mind, it was more downbeat than you remembered it.
Yeah, it was. It really was.
And did you see it pretty close to the time it came out, when it would have been pretty recent?
I got invited to the premiere that they had in Leicester Square back in whenever it was, 70 or whatever. It was all right.
Yeah, relatively fresh, though, at the time to where you can think to 18 months before, well, this isn't quite how I remembered it.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, you're kind of caught up in the whole moment thing, so it's only later that you think, yeah, actually, I do remember things being a little bit happier than that.
And now we've seen eight more hours with Get Back, Peter Jackson. Now, I know that from when we talked before, you had said that you never really told your wife much about your Beatle background, and it wasn't something you lived with as like the greatest moment in your life. You had another career after that. You had other bands you worked with. You had all kinds of life experiences in the years beyond that. And it was only in more recent years that you set down your memoirs in that book, The Redhead on the Roof, going back to the Beatle days, which obviously people to this day have a great deal of interest in. So upon being transported back to January 1969 in the space of the 8 hours Peter Jackson gave us, what was that like for you?
In all honesty, Robert, I found it to watch us, right? I found it very boring. You see, the thing is, most of my life with the Beatles was hanging around.
Right. A lot of downtime?
You know, it was a lot of downtime. And working in the studio, at times, it was seriously boring. You're sitting around for 3-4 hours doing absolutely nothing, waiting for the call. And so that's what I had in my head when I was watching this. It was like being there. And for me, it was just, I've seen it all. For 2 years, I saw them doing what I saw them on the film. So it didn't really excite me. It was just kind of, yeah, that's what I was doing. Oh, yes, of course, that happened. I had to watch it over several hours. Those 8 hours took me all in all about a week and a half to watch because I just had to keep stopping. But in the end, I, to be honest with you and your listeners, I fast-forwarded it a lot of it because I wasn't really interested in the conversation that all of you guys are interested in. To me, I'd heard him once and was there and I watched it all happening and watched 3 albums happening the way you guys watched that album happening. So it wasn't really a great excitement to me, I must admit. It was just looking back on what an 18, 19-year-old did.
It seems like what it was doing was bringing back to you, even without you seeing it, because obviously he didn't put the 4 hours of tedium on the screen in between the good bits, but that's what grabbed you, being put back into that situation, seeing yourself, seeing the room. Immediately, your brain transported you back to, oh God, all that downtime.
Yeah. But at the same time, you're looking at what they're asking of you or what you're doing up on the screen, and it's, you know, I mean, the classic is when George left. You know, until I saw the film this time around, I didn't know I was standing right next to him when he left. I'd forgotten all about that. In my mind's eye, I was on the other side of the studios. And a lot of that I realize now is to do with I never got involved with their conversations. So I'm sort of thinking of in my mind's eye, there's something happening that I can see, which is George putting his coat on, to my brain going, well, that must have been when he left. And that's what I put in the book. I didn't know what was going on because I was a long way away. But then to see the film, and I'm actually standing right next to George, and I don't even remember that. That was pretty mind-boggling, I must admit. You know, I was that near, and it didn't even twig, you know. But it was just one of those things with the Beatles, no matter what they said or did, that initial thing never impacted me because they're just having a conversation. So I only get involved when it's Kevin or I hear an instrument mentioned or whatever. So I just kept out of all of that.
You're focusing entirely on your job and what's required of you and nothing else.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, I wasn't in that position as a confidant. I was trusted, but I was never spoken to about policy or anything like that. It was just, here I am. What do you want me to do? Don't ask me what you think I should.
They never ask you to weigh in. Kevin, what do you think of this lyric? Is there a better word we can use?
Yeah, that's right. But well, that could happen with Mal.
Right.
But not with me. I couldn't never see that happening. And so Mal picked it up, what George was saying and everything, because he was always conscious of what their conversations were about, where I just heard, but I never listened, really.
So at this distance, the entire situation, as you reflect back on it, the overriding sense you get is the tedium, the long periods being on call and not being tasked with anything. Were you aware of that in the moment as it was happening, or was there still some sort of buzz about, oh, I'm 18, 19 years old, I'm working in the studio with the Beatles, this is cool? Or it was like, it's just another day at work.
It was just another day at work. It's, you know that you're going to go into the studio at 6:30. You know you're going to set up. You know that they're going to turn up in between 7 and 7:30. You know by 8 o'clock they'll be sitting down going through whatever as you will see on the film, you know, so you know all of that, and you know at about 8:30, you'll have time to walk out and go and get a cup of tea yourself, because they would have got into the evening musically amongst themselves. So, you know, you're not going to be needed for at least an hour, hour and a half while they're working out this new song. And so it's a lot of just hurry up and wait. And you just try and make your own little world of comfort. I mean, the first thing is you have a joint. Okay, right, here we go. Another evening.
And get paid for it.
And get paid for it. Yeah. I think I would have done it for nothing.
Yeah.
Have extra on the first one, sir. Health scale. Hello. Even though I may not be singing it moving along, I'm just trying to maybe get to the bottom of it, and just imagine. At the end, if it's gone well at the end, do that winding back the tape thing. Because I just will end up on Helter Skelter, Helter Skelter, yeah, Helter Skelter. I'll just sort of pull out of it and watch me. Jump
on. Were there moments when you were going from, you had originally been working as part of the office when Brian had first brought you in, and now you're suddenly in the studio, now you're part of the environment with the Beatles where they're actually making music. Do you ever remember any specific moments where, as they're working on a song and it comes into shape, some kind of performance that grabbed you and like, wow, this is really cool. I'm hearing something here. This is going to be the next Beatles hit record. Do you remember any moments like that, or was a lot of it just, they're not there yet, they're going to slog through this, and it's going to be a long time until they get something recognizable as, oh yeah, that's a hit record?
It would be, okay, they're just doing what they're doing, and then 4 hours later, you could certainly tap your feet to it or whatever, but it wouldn't be till hours later that all the backing track's down, and you can finally sort of hear what's going on. You've heard the lyrics because maybe Paul or John has been singing them while they're doing the backing tracks or whatever. But there's no ever sort of revelatory, wow. It was just, okay, that's another night out the way. For everybody, it was just, okay, it's in the bag, right, let's go, see you tomorrow. And that's how it was. I never thought that's going to be an amazing hit or whatever. For me, it was all good music. I was quite happy. For me, it was good just being able to sing a Beatles song at the end of an evening before anybody else had heard it, really, you know. Or hum the tune as in walking down the corridor. That was a good feeling. I do remember that, thinking, wow, yeah, here I am singing Beatles song before it's on a record. That was all right.
Outside of work and outside of the studio, do you remember having experiences with your friends who knew what you were doing and maybe you shared that information with, or would ask you, what are the Beatles up to? Is it cool? You know, that kind of thing?
You would get that, but I would talk about the music, I guess. But there wouldn't be any sort of, you know, deep Beatles revelations. It would just be, yeah, it was just, this happened last night. Or I'm sure I did, but what I said, I don't remember. But it would have just been about the music and the actual buzz of doing what I was doing, I think. You see, really, Robert, you'd have to sort of go and try and find out all of these people that I used to know me, and maybe they'll be able to tell you.
So you were around during the making of the White Album in front of the Let It Be Get Back sessions. And a lot of people have been conflicted in what they've described as what the sort of atmosphere was like, with Yoko a sudden fixture at Beatles sessions, whatever girl Paul had around the time. And if I'm not mistaken, that was your first experience being in the studio with the Beatles, was the White Album sessions?
Yeah, yeah. Any other experiences that sort of happened, you know, like with Yoko coming down or with Linda or whatever, it was a new experience to me. So I couldn't immediately say, this has changed in the studio, because I never knew what the studio was like beforehand.
You had no frame of reference. It was all normal.
Yeah, that's right. It was. I heard comments, you know, what George thought and Ringo and Paul. It's all been said before. So I guess I just sort of agree with what they're saying. that's how it was back then. But to me, it was all new, so I couldn't really go, wow, she changed it this way, because I didn't know which way it had been changed from.
But were you sensitive to the environment in the sense of this is tense, this is uncomfortable, or this is relaxed?
Yeah, occasionally, once or twice, but in an instant, it's kind of gone because you're on to the next thing. You know, your head's okay, that's a little bit tense, but you know, there's tensions around bands all the time anyway, I've discovered.
Sure.
After 20 years, you know, what I saw with the Beatles, I've now worked out, it's normal. It's a rock and roll band. That's what happens. So, yeah, that was a weird one.
And you do get the sense, even though it's very much time compressed and it's only what was caught on film, but what you're describing, you see throughout the 8 hours of Get Back, is they can go from a moment of tension to a moment of great bonding and connecting, having fun on a dime. It just seems like that's the normal atmosphere around a band.
Yeah, that's the atmosphere that I always remember. It was the good time. Sure, you know, a bit of tension comes in, but generally, I remember just the happiness. Overall, we all know that there was tension there occasionally, but for me, when I look at it,
the fun is what sticks in your head.
Yeah, yeah, it was great.
Were you around when Ringo walked out during the White Album sessions?
I was. And yet again, Robert, this is the weird thing, because one minute Ringo was there and the next he wasn't. And then he didn't come back for a couple of days. I don't really remember it, but I remember Mal getting loads of flowers one day because he was coming back. But yet again, that was just something which kind of didn't register in my consciousness, because I wasn't around when all those little things happened that got him to leave. But I was still learning, so I didn't understand any of that. In my head, I just remember all the flowers around the drum kit when he came back. You know, you know, I walked in and Mal had just arranged this floral display.
Speaking of your connection with Mal, I know he's been getting a lot of attention of late, both through Peter Jackson's film and through the book project that's been going on and the discussion you were with last year with Ken Womack. So it seems like it's clear that you guys had a close relationship, working and probably friendship as well. When you speak of him and you tell the story about carrying a guitar pick in your wallet to this day, it's obviously a very deep, meaningful thing. Were you that close when you were working with him? Did he confide in you as sort of the liaison between the Beatles and you?
No, not really. The only time I really heard Mal say anything was, I think they'd been having a few discussions where they'd come back from Apple during the day, having business meetings, you know, the Alan Klein bit and all of that stuff. And then we'd get into the studios. Mal just one night just said, I don't like them arguing. I don't like the way they're arguing. And that was the only concern, really, that I remember Mal saying to me. That particular moment just kind of stuck in my head. We were together every night in the studio from 7 till whenever we finished. So we did a lot of speaking, but you know what it's like. You're with somebody for 8 hours, you're just chatting. Don't really remember the conversations. And I'm sure he most probably did voice it, but the only one thing I remember was when he said that, you know, oh, I don't like it when the boys argue.
You know. Do you remember how you reacted to that? Like, was it something telling you something you already kind of knew? Or, oh, wow, things are reaching that point that even you're commenting on it?
No, that didn't consciously enter into my head. But yet again, it could have done. But sadly, when I left the Beatles, all of that just went away. So all of those memories, all those little stories that I would have had kind of just disappeared because I was on to the next trip.
After the Beatle years, were you guys crossing paths as he was trying to make his way as a producer and you were working with other bands?
No, that's the thing. When you go on the road, you really don't see anybody. It's when you come back off the road and you get open your address book, and if you're that way inclined, then you'll ring up old friends and things. But I was so busy trying to work. But then I got a phone call from Mal to do the concert for Bangladesh. So that was a good one. That was nice. But that was one of the few times I saw him after we left. I'm sure I saw him a couple of times because I worked with Wishbone and we did some recording at Apple.
Would he have been around Apple after the Beatles split?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, that was a bit weird.
Oh, how so?
Just being back at Apple, just being in the studio.
Oh, just the memories of what you experienced there?
Yeah, just being there. Yeah, it was just kind of weird. I'm not really feeling free enough to go upstairs to the office because I wasn't a part of it. You know, once you leave, you go upstairs, you say hello, but and then you can't, after, you know, a week, you can't sort of be going up there just to hang around, just having a chat and a cup of tea, which is what I used to do. But yeah, so no, Mal and I, it's just one of those things, you know, you just don't see people when you're touring.
So you're working at Apple Studios with Wishbone Ash. Did they have any particular awe of their environment from being there where the Beatles had done so much?
I think they might have done, but you'd have to ask them.
Uh-huh. You stay in touch?
No, I haven't seen anybody for years. I saw Andy Powell about 4 years ago, but that's about it.
And for the sake of the listeners that haven't read your book yet or heard any other interviews with you, after the Beatles, Wishbone Ash was one of the acts you went on the road with, and what were some of the other acts?
Well, it was Derek and the Dominoes, which is in the book. Wishbone Ash, Ted Nugent, Tina Turner, Cheap Trick, Mother's Finest, Motorhead, loads of cabaret stuff like Matt Monro, Petula Clark. I did 2 years in cabaret in the Middle East. So
wow,
I did some weird stuff. Yeah, Kid Creole and the Coconuts, Steve Harley, Cockney Rebel. Did I say Cheap Trick?
You did, yeah. They're local boys here.
It's almost like I'd have to look at the list and go down it. But yeah, there was a lot of touring.
Did your status as somebody who'd worked with the Beatles and was prominently seen in the Let It Be film, when you're working with these bands, did they like know you upon meeting you as like, oh, that guy?
No. I mean, I'm sure the people that I was working for, like the agents and the management that I was working for that were getting me these jobs with these bands, I'm sure they would have said it, but no, it was almost always the previous band that you'd been touring with. So you spoke about it, but you never really. I think a lot of people sort of, because I didn't just come in and go, hey, I work for the Beatles, da-di-da-di-da, and this is what I did. I never said anything.
Right. I don't see you doing that.
If somebody said, oh, you work for the Beatles, yeah, it wasn't sort of
worn on your sleeve.
Yeah, it was just another band that I worked with.
Right, just another band. Cheap Trick is a local band from where I am in Chicago. They're,
oh, is it?
Yeah, up the road in Rockford. I've probably seen them more than any other band I've ever seen because they just are around, you know. But they are a band that has a lot of Beatlesisms to their work. And as you probably know, Rick Nielsen and Bunny recorded with John Lennon in 1980. So they almost certainly would have known who you were.
It's interesting to me if they would have like cornered you and like sat you down. So tell us what it was like. You know, I could see them doing that.
I'm sure they did.
Yeah.
But I just don't remember it. It's just one of those, Robert. These things are fleeting and you speak to so many people about it, not in depth, but it always comes up. And I'm sure I did because everybody wants to know. And it's always, well, what do you want? You want the short version or do you want the long version? Yeah, so they normally just get an appraisal of the short version because you just don't have time to tell people what it was really like. You can only go, it was fantastic. I had a great time. Sorry, but I've got a show to do, you know, and then you're away or I've got to go and I've got to get a flight. So it was difficult and sometimes it was embarrassing because you've got to sort of shoo them off.
Not deal with the fanboys.
Yeah. Funny, I've got a pair of Bunnies drumsticks.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, you know the big three-footers?
Yeah.
Play with it at the end of the show.
Right. Good night now.
Yeah, it took me a week to get him off and to persuade him to leave them to me when he went back to America. Yeah.
Yeah. They're like baseball bats.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. Right. A bit of hickory.
Yeah. Yeah, he comes. There's a drum show they do every year around here, so I usually see him there.
I doubt if he'll remember me, except unless I'm the one he remembers giving his drumsticks to.
Yeah, I'll mention it next time.
Say hello to him.
Yeah, for sure. So last year when we did the event, you were part of two segments, one being with the Mel Evans bit, and then the other one being talking about The Rooftop with Chris O'Dell and Alan Parsons. And it was really nice to see you and Alan reconnect. After clearly you guys had memories of working together, and that was one of the fun aspects of the thing. So you remember him pretty well at the level you were working as he's tape op and you were assisting Mel.
The weird thing, Robert, I couldn't honestly place Alan in my head, but I know that we worked together.
Uh-huh.
So there's a bond there that I know I made him loads of tea. So there's just a bond there, but it was a weird one. It was good. It was nice. Seeing him, just, oh, yeah, okay, excellent. Another one that made it good.
Yeah, but outside of like two ships passing, you didn't feel a deeper friendship beyond that?
No, because it's a working relationship. You know, he's working for EMI as a taper, and I'm the roadie. So, yeah, no, you chat and you have cups of tea, and then he goes upstairs to do his job, and I sit down and wait to do my job, and then at the end of the night, clear up or whatever, and then see in the morning, and then it just happens again. He's up near his machines going, up downstairs going, and so that was the life.
Yeah, we bond forever over that.
It was all right.
John Leckie has been on the show a few times. Do you remember being around him? Another tape op?
Which album was he on?
So he joined EMI in early 70, and he did a bit on Sentimental Journey and on McCartney, but then he worked on Plastic Ono Band and All Things Must Pass.
I'm sure we did, but it's one of those.
Sure, sure. Okay. And then he went on, of course, to that fabulous career as a producer with Stone Roses and Radiohead.
There you go. You see, it's yet again another EMI success story.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, they churned them out, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. So did your family see any of the Get Back, Doc?
No, I don't think so. I'm sure my son might have seen some of it, but I haven't spoken to them about it, to be honest.
Okay.
I'm not too sure what they've seen, whether they have seen any, because I don't think they see me really, unless it's by accident.
Uh-huh. Well, you're in it a lot. And that's the thing that I know, if somebody dug up video of my father when he was 19 years old walking around at work, I would find it fascinating, especially if it's something you don't really talk about. So I would wonder what their impression was of seeing that, seeing you at that age. And it's like, wow, he never talks about this stuff.
Matt, who was in hospital at the time, he watched a bit of it. And he was quite amazed the way his dad looked in high definition.
Better than real life.
Yeah, apart from that, I haven't really sort of said, well, Dad, you look good or whatever. Although, personally, I must admit, I do look quite buff.
Quite buff?
Yeah. And that's because carrying all the equipment. That was the one thing I did spot about myself, besides the hair being really bright. Yeah, I was quite well built. That was an interesting one.
That's a heavy job. And when I think about the stuff you've described about the rooftop, especially having to remove that skylight and get Billy Preston's gear through it, it must have been unbelievable, the demands placed on you guys.
At the time, it didn't seem like it. And having been a proper roadie, that was really nothing. When I've had to load up an Arctic, just getting those two amps and the bass amp and the piano up on the roof and the drum kit was nothing. When you're loading up an Arctic with flight cases, then that's something else. Yeah. I mean, a lot of it was up and down the stairs with these cabinets at EMI, you know, going from studio to studio or some little room down the way, or putting an amp in an echo chamber to see what that sounded like and stuff. Certainly, there was a lot of carrying around. And those twin reverbs were not light.
Oh, the Fenders, yeah.
I remember that as an 18-year-old. They were not light.
Mm-mm. Yeah, I've lifted those myself. If people care about this stuff, we've noticed this and we've talked about it on the show, that in the earliest footage of Twickenham, you see Paul's 1961 Hofner bass as distinct from the 63 one that he mostly played. The 61 became his backup. But he's shown playing it at Twickenham. And then you see it very briefly at Apple Studio. And the story is that there was a break-in somewhere. I don't know if it was at EMI, but somewhere. But that 61 Hofner bass has been missing since 1969. And apparently some other stuff was taken too. Do you know anything about that?
Don't remember anything about that.
Yeah, because I would think it'd been kind of a big deal. But it's something that in recent years, there's been movements trying to get Paul reunited with that bass because some people think they know where it is and where it ended up and all that stuff.
I do not even remember it going missing, to be honest.
So when you think about those years, and you've had time to think about it when you wrote your memoir, and I'm certain since Get Back, you've probably been reached out to by a lot of people wanting to get your impressions of it. Is there any particular memories that you've been carrying around these years that stand out of that period? Not just Get Back, but just the Beatles generally?
The biggest one is kneeling in front of John. That's ridiculous.
That must be the one you get asked about the most.
Well, this is another one, Robert. In my book, I say that John wanted a music stand. We didn't have one. So I just became a music stand. In the film, he's actually asked me if I could hold the lyrics. Well, I didn't remember that. So that's why I became a music stand, because John asked me to hold the lyrics, whereas I always just assumed that we didn't have a music stand. So I just got down on my knees. That was a revelation to me. Okay, good.
As was the moment when George walks out and you thought you were across the stage and you were actually right next to him when it happened.
Yeah, that was bizarre. But yet again, that only sticks in my mind now because I saw it on the film. All this original stuff, everything sort of sticks out.
What's the next one?
I'll have to get the words.
So you're talking?
Just ask Mal to hold them.
Yeah.
Kevin.
Kevin, come here.
Are you all ready? Yeah. Okay, are we rolling? Yeah. Okay.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. If the Beatles taught us anything, it's that there is always something better in life for us if we seek it out. George was fond of quoting, "For the forest to be green, each tree must be green." That's just another way of saying, for the world to become a better place, each of us has to put our own house in order. BetterHelp is a group of professional therapists providing help online. Traditionally, there has been a stigma attached to getting help or even admitting that you could use it, but that's fading more and more. With BetterHelp, it's never been easier to get help geared to the needs of the individual, both in terms of how you can connect, by video, voice calls, chats, or messages, as well as finding a therapist suited to you, worldwide. With BetterHelp, you can find peace of mind on your own terms. If you act now, you can get 10% off your first month. Just go to betterhelp.com/satby. Again, that's BetterHelp, not health, but help, like the song in the film, .com/SATB.
There you go. My brain is full of these small little visual stories that this happened, I remember that, but that only lasted 30 seconds. Or I remember that. Oh, that's a 10-second memory. You know, and then you've got the kneeling in front of John, you know, who's the one, and sitting down with George when I first started on the Double White album. That's always a brilliant memory for me. I love that one.
Can you describe that one to the listeners?
Yeah, it was my first night as being a roadie, my first night of working down in the studios. And I was kind of nervous. So I was standing, hiding behind a monitor, studio monitor, and George was just on the floor, just playing a guitar. And he spotted me and he said, "Kevin, come on over, you know, sit down. Let's have a chat." And so I sat down and we chatted for about 10 or 15 minutes. And just, it was lovely. After that, yeah, okay, this is not going to be as bad as I thought maybe. So it kind of just relaxed me, just, yeah, that was okay. You know, I'd spoken to them before at Apple in the office, you know, but only as an office boy going, "Here's this that you asked for," or, "Yeah, I can get that for you," or whatever. And so just to sit down in the studio on the floor with George, just chatting about where I'd come from and what I'd done. And we'd discovered that we'd both ridden the same sort of bikes, which are delivery bikes with a big basket on the front. Whereas I think George used to deliver meat for a butcher's. I delivered loaves of bread for a grocer's to local hotels around where I lived in Oban. So it was nice. It was just, that's a sweet memory for me because that gave me a nice relaxing in.
You remember having similar talks with the others, or was it just George that made a point?
I chatted with them all, I suppose. You know, you do when you're sitting in a control room or there's only you and them or whatever. You know, it's difficult to pinpoint, yeah, I remember speaking with John about this, or I remember speaking with Paul about it. I spoke with all of them every single day. What about? About what was in the paper, about the weather, about other musical bands. It's just whatever was coming up in an every single day ordinary conversation that anybody would have anywhere in the world.
Right. Water cooler talk with their coworkers.
Yeah, and that's how it was. If you're sitting there and he's sitting there, then you talk. If he's not reading the paper, of course, or whatever, you chat. That's what you do. They were wonderful to be with them. They were regular boys. I've discovered regular musicians.
Biggest rock stars on the planet, and they treated you like a friend, like anybody else would.
Yeah. Yeah, but as I said, Robert, you know, what I've discovered in the next 20-odd years, they're just an ordinary band. They had the same hang-ups, the same problems, you know, the same fun, the same laughs that every single band I think I ever worked with had. They were just a rock and roll band. They just happened to be the Beatles. In themselves, they were just the four lads that like to play music together. That's how I see them. I don't see them as a big worldwide phenomenon, but I know that they are. In my head, they're just another band that I've worked for, having seen all these other bands over the years. In my heart, there's something definitely in there because of the experiences that I had as an 18-year-old. But I just see them as just another band that I worked for in reality. And I love it that way because they're just musicians.
Probably exactly how they would want to be thought of anyway.
I should imagine so. I think I've heard them say that, but that's how I personally see them. Just some good musicians I really enjoyed working for.
I don't think you could have done your job if you had them on a pedestal at that moment.
Yeah, that's the other thing. I think maybe that's why Mal kind of realized that I wasn't a Beatles freak, I suppose. You know,
right, that wouldn't have worked.
I was just the red-headed guy that Mal had known for 2 years, or seen about for 2 years.
Do you have any particular memories of putting together or working with them on the Bangladesh benefit?
Bangladesh?
Yeah. It was done very fast.
Yeah, it was. I think I spent about 5 days in New York. I got memories of rehearsing down in a basement, I think in the basement of Madison Square Gardens, I think. And that is, or it might have been around the corner. This is one of those. But yeah, it was just sort of a mad 5 days. Ended up in this absolute amazing night. You know, two shows.
There were the issues around, is Clapton going to show up? Is Dylan going to show up? Do you remember having to deal with that stuff?
Well, yet again, you see, being a roadie, you just hear the rumors, you know, that Eric's hoping to get out. This would be coming from Mal to me, you see. Mal would be like, you know, I think he said, you know, Eric's here or whatever. So everything was all right, you know. So it was touch and go, but in the end, he turned up. I didn't know that Dylan might not show up. I always thought he was just scheduled to show, so that's how much I know. Whoever was there played, I guess. You know, all I did was just set up all of this equipment, along with Badfinger's roadie, by the way, Nicky Bell.
Oh, yeah.
Was also there, because we had Badfinger, you know, so Nicky was there helping as well, besides me.
Were you around Badfinger very much during that time?
Yeah, quite a bit. Yeah, definitely. We'd see them when they came into Apple, and I'd maybe go out for a drink or two with the roadies. Yeah, they were just good. They were fun.
Any particular impressions of them musically or as people?
No. Yet again, as far as I'm concerned, Robert, they were just a bunch of musicians. I was really then only learning about musicians and getting to grips with rock and roll music. So yet again, they were just like a bunch of musicians. You know, they were my age. they were fun. You know, there was no hang-ups with them as far as I knew. They would come in, we'd have a laugh. You know, they would go. I'd maybe go down to the studio because Mal's producing them or something. So I might sort of go and say hello to Mal and stay there for an hour or whatever. It was just loose. Yeah, they were lovely lads as far as I remember.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, because I knew that Mal had worked with him early on. If you were working with Mal, if you'd been privy to those sessions or just connecting with him generally?
Just connecting with them generally, I think. When a band's got their own roadies, you know, you don't really want to be a hanger-on, but sometimes, you know, you can walk into a studio because everybody knows you. And that's how I felt. I could walk into a studio because everybody knew me. You know, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you turn up.
Right, sure.
You know, they're working.
Well, I can't forget this evening and your face when you were leaving. But I guess that's just the way the story goes. You always smile, but in your eyes your sorrow shows. Yes, it shows. I had you there, then I let you go. And now it's only fair that I should let you know what you should know. Can live, living is without you.
Did you have much in the way of interactions with Phil Spector when he was around?
Yeah, a bit.
Any impressions?
Yeah, that was something else.
Did his reputation precede him?
Yes, it did. It did. There was kind of a bit of an expectation when we were told that he was coming. The one guy, I mean, he was mad, you know, really up in the air. But the one guy I felt sorry for was his bodyguard, because Phil basically didn't sleep. So this bodyguard used to trail him behind Phil every night at about 7 o'clock, his eyes as red as beetroot, just like half open. You could see that all he wanted to do was just sleep. That's all he wanted to do was sleep. But Phil wouldn't let him because Phil was on the go and just this poor man. But yeah, Phil was all right. What I found was I was in the control room and I'm listening to this wall of sound. And all of a sudden, hey, do you hear that? And I'm thinking, hear what? What did you hear? What was coming out of that wall that you that you heard that, and it's just like, wow, how do you differentiate between all of that sound to one bum note? Where does that come from? You know, it's just like, because I think that night, I think we had something like 8 guitars in the studio. We had to go and try and get some session musicians from somewhere, and that was it. Just one night, you know, hey, I need 8 guitarists. Mal, need 8 guitarists. Acoustic. Well, okay. So I think Mal came up with about 6, and I got a couple. I got one from Wishbone and one from Rupert's People. Well, he was all right. I liked his company.
This was during the All Things Must Pass sessions?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So 3 of them were probably Badfinger.
Could well have been. Could well have been. I mean, they might have been gigging. I can't remember. I know we had a few session musicians. He was all right. A bit eccentric.
But what an ear.
But what an ear. Yeah. You know, to be able to hear this bum note coming out of a wall is pretty spectacular.
Were you at the Instant Karma session?
No.
Okay. Because I think that was the first time he came to EMI working with a Beatle, and that was January 70.
I don't think I was, because it was Plastic Ono Band.
Yeah, well, George was there, and Billy was there, and Klaus was there.
And I never had anything to do with Plastic Ono Band.
And Mal was there, too.
Yeah, I only got involved once with Plastic Ono Band, and that was when Mal rang me up and said, oh, we're doing a gig at the Lyceum, and we need a couple of amplifiers. Can you bring some down? And I was like, oh, right, okay. Didn't even know John was playing. So that was getting towards the end of my tenure with the Beatles anyway. Because they're broken up.
Yeah, that was December of 69. And you had George there and Keith Moon and the Delaney and Bonnie troupe and Clapton.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was only invited at the last minute just to bring some amps down. I was not needed. That was not Beatles.
Right. Did you stick around for the show?
Oh, yeah, just because I had to take the amps back.
Any memories of that night?
Only Yoko singing in a bag.
That's enough of
Yeah, not impressed, but there you go. But that I was young.
Sure.
I didn't know any better, Robert. No, Robert, it was just an amazing time for me. And on reflection, it is a shame that I can't remember more, because so much happened. But that's one of the problems. So much happened in those 2 years that I just couldn't absorb it all, really. It was so intense for an 18-year-old. I can understand now why I can't quite remember everything, because it was next day something's happening. You start something in the morning and in the afternoon it's something's changed, and you forget about it because you're doing something new, and you're moving forward all of the time and you forget what you've just done.
And it's all extraordinary when you look back at it, and maybe because this was your normal, you don't see it as anything exceptional until you've had the years to look back and the life experience.
That's the problem, you see. Everything that I can kind of clearly remember was exceptional, and everything else was kind of just the normal. But to yourselves and other Beatles people, that normal for me is extraordinary for you, because you want to find out more. And sadly, I can't sort of go, yeah, this is definitely what happened, because I wouldn't want to speculate. You know, I've been held up once or twice because what I've said is factually incorrect. But I think I say in the book, actually, some of the details are not exactly, they did happen, but maybe just not in the way or in the timeline that I say in the book. So it was an amazing time, and I just wish I could remember more. But the guy I went with Derek and the Dominoes, the tour manager, Bruce McCaskill, during the tour, on the, he said to me, you know, Kevin, you should write a book. So this was would be back in 71. And I think I said to him, no, I'll never write a book because that's not what I was there for. You know, but now I look back thinking, Jesus, if I'd written that book then, all the stories I would have remembered, it would have just come, it would have been a novel. So that's it, really.
Well, what you do retain, you've got enough of the parameters in the framework. And if you want to let your mind fill in the details, you can still come up with that novel yet.
Yeah, but it's the heart that's got all the parameters in there. It comes from the heart, a lot of it. You know, I just wish up here could fill in a lot what the heart feels.
Right.
The long and winding road that leads to your door will never disappear. I've seen that road before.
Something About the Beatles, created and hosted by Robert Rodriguez, sponsored by BetterHelp. Go to betterhelp.com/Zappy for 10% off your first month. Executive producer Rick Way, title song by The Corgis.